Escuelas oficiales de idiomas. Pruebas de certificación. Comprensión oral. Inglés. Certificado de nivel intermedio. Tarea 1. Dispone de un minuto para leer los ejercicios correspondientes a esta tarea. A continuación de la lectura, escuchará dos veces el texto o los textos orales correspondientes a la tarea 1, con un intervalo de 20 segundos. Tarea 1. Primera audición.
Now we all know the weekly food shop can be a bit of a drudge, made worse by the sizable dent it tends to leave in your wallet. But despite all the money we spend, the big four supermarkets are feeling the pinch, whereas discounters like this one are enjoying something of a boom. Now in the past, discounters were seen as cheap, but perhaps lower quality than the others. Now, though, they're successfully marketing themselves not only as cheap, but perhaps even better quality than the big boys. Aldi is officially the UK's fastest growing food retailer, having boosted its sales by over 35% since the start of the year. Lidl's not far behind, with increased sales of 17% for the same period. Over half of UK shoppers, 51%, visit a discount food store each month now. And in the past 2 years, the number of us using discounters to do our main weekly shop has more than doubled, from 5% to 12%. So, what's their secret?
When you walk into an Aldi, for example, you only have the choice of around 1,300-1,400 products compared to the 30,000 you would have in a supermarket. So by keeping the number of products to a minimum, focusing on own label ranges, it means that they're able to deal with far fewer suppliers, and that helps to keep costs down.
It's all down to actually what you see is what you get, and that's what's attracting UK shoppers, is that the prices that they can afford to charge are significantly lower in some cases than that of our big four, who traditionally have been the price leaders and the price champions.
To find out why the discounters are increasingly attractive to shoppers, we enlisted the help of some discount supermarket skeptics. In Cheshire, the Moore Youssef family comprises six-year-old Ruby, her older brother Rafi, and her little sister Tali. The kids have growing appetites, and mum Kate combines running her own PR business with managing the household. Dad Jamie specialises in quality control.
What's it called?
The sorbetti.
The sorbetti.
Most weeks, Kate does the family shop online and has it delivered right to her door by Ocado.
It's all there on a sort of a shopping list that I've already created, and so instead of sort of taking an hour and a half out of my day, it's done in 20 minutes, 15 minutes maximum. The quality of the products is very important to me. I love to be able to cook fresh food from scratch. So I'd probably shop it every 10 days and spend about £120-130 every 10 days.
But we've asked Kate to try discount supermarket Aldi for a change.
The Aldi near me is, it's a good 15 minutes away. So if it is very much cheaper, then maybe. But, I'll wait and see if I can be converted.
Then there's London-based professionals Anton and Jackie, who see themselves as connoisseurs of the good things in life. Can we convert them?
I normally shop at Waitrose because I like the quality that they have, the consistency in the products that they carry.
And we care more about quality, and I don't think they have that at discount stores. Price does sometimes come into play, and so sometimes we'll do a bit of a comparison maybe between Marks & Spencer's and Waitrose. I think each week we probably spend about £100 on food.
Yes, I think £100 a week would be a good estimate.
We've asked them to try out Lidl, currently the UK's other main discounter and Aldi's closest rival. Anton and Jackie's main concern is about quality, especially when it comes to luxury items like champagne.
Tarea 1. Segunda audición.
Now, we all know the weekly food shop can be a bit of a drudge, made worse by the sizeable dent it tends to leave in your wallet. But despite all the money we spend, the big four supermarkets are feeling the pinch, whereas discounters like this one are enjoying something of a boom. Now, in the past, discounters were seen as cheap, but perhaps lower quality than the others. Now, though, they're successfully marketing themselves not only as cheap, but perhaps even better quality than the big boys. Aldi is officially the UK's fastest growing food retailer, having boosted its sales by over 35% since the start of the year. Lidl's not far behind, with increased sales of 17% for the same period. Over half of UK shoppers, 51%, visit a discount food store each month now. And in the past 2 years, the number of us using discounters to do our main weekly shop has more than doubled, from 5% to 12%. So, what's their secret?
When you walk into an Aldi, for example, you only have the choice of around 1,300 products compared to the 30,000 you would have in a supermarket. So by keeping the number of products to a minimum, focusing on own label ranges, it means that they're able to deal with far fewer suppliers, and that helps to keep costs down.
It's all down to actually what you see is what you get, and that's what's attracting UK shoppers, is that the prices that they can afford to charge are significantly lower in some cases than that of our big four, who traditionally have been the price leaders and the price champions.
To find out why the discounters are increasingly attractive to shoppers, we enlisted the help of some discount supermarket sceptics. In Cheshire, the Moore Youssef family comprises six-year-old Ruby, her older brother Rafi, and her little sister Tali. The kids have growing appetites, and mum Kate combines running her own PR business with managing the household. Dad Jamie specialises in quality control.
What's it called?
The sorbetti.
The sorbetti.
Most weeks, Kate does the family shop online and has it delivered right to her door by Ocado.
It's all there on a sort of a shopping list that I've already created, and so instead of sort of taking an hour and a half out of my day, it's done in 20 minutes, 15 minutes maximum. The quality of the products is very important to me. I love to be able to cook fresh food from scratch. So I'd probably shop it every 10 days and spend about £120-130 every 10 days.
But we've asked Kate to try discount supermarket Aldi for a change.
The Aldi near me is a good 15 minutes away, so if it is very much cheaper, then maybe. But, I'll wait and see if I can be converted.
Then there's London-based professionals Anton and Jackie, who see themselves as connoisseurs of the good things in life. Can we convert them?
I normally shop at Waitrose because I like the quality that they have, the consistency in the products that they carry.
And we care more about quality, and I don't think they have that at discount stores. Price does sometimes come into play, and so sometimes we'll do a bit of a comparison maybe between Marks & Spencer's and Waitrose. I think each week we probably spend about £100 on food.
Yes, I think each £100 a week would be a good estimate.
We've asked them to try out Lidl, currently the UK's other main discounter and Aldi's closest rival. Anton and Jackie's main concern is about quality, especially when it comes to luxury items like champagne.
Tarea 2. Dispone de un minuto para leer los ejercicios correspondientes a esta tarea. A continuación de la lectura, escuchará dos veces el texto o los textos orales correspondientes a la tarea 2, con un intervalo de 20 segundos. Tarea 2. Primera audición.
Each year, Joe Citizen discards more than half a ton of garbage. Everything from empty pizza boxes and eggshells to broken dishes, appliances, old tires, and the kitchen sink. Worldwide, that's almost a billion tons of stinking trash every year. And somehow, all of it needs to be either recycled or otherwise disposed of. So, how do they do it? It's 6 a.m. in the San Francisco Bay Area, and Micah Bate and his refuse-wrangling colleague, John Fuston, are starting their weekly garbage collection round. For most of us, remembering to put out our trash bins is the end of the story. But in fact, it's just the beginning of an extraordinary, epic journey. A few years ago, strong men had to wrangle your garbage into the back of their truck. These days, a robot arm takes over that duty. One truck for recyclables, another for the truly trashy. Thanks to these robotic refuse collectors, Mike and John can empty 600 bins every trip. And once they're full of trash, the trucks head for a delightful spot known as the Davis Street Transfer Center. Trucks carrying waste for recycling deposit their load here. To you and me, it just looks like rubbish. But to the discerning eye, there's gold in them there hills. Each truckload is worth hundreds of dollars, but no one is going to pay for it in its present state. First, these vast mountains of trash need to be separated into the various components of paper, metals, plastics, and glass. Doing that by hand would require a small army. So it's a good thing they have George Atrastain and a friendly garbage monster known as the Single Stream Recycling Facility.
It's pretty incredible. It's noisy, it's dirty, it's very unglamorous, but it's a fun place to be.
George's smelly monster is a state-of-the-art garbage sorting machine. Housed in a building that's barely 300 feet long, it contains almost a mile of conveyor belts. Constantly fed by loaders, it can sort over 300 tons of waste every day and relies on George to keep the wheels turning. First, high-power fans blast a jet of air through the trash, suspending lighter paper, metal, and plastic, leaving the heavier glass bottles to fall into a separate pile.
Next, a steep conveyor bounces the garbage across a series of rubber wheels. This causes the light paper products to continue upwards, while heavier metals and plastics drop down onto yet another conveyor belt.
Tarea 2. Segunda audición.
Each year, Joe Citizen discards more than half a ton of garbage. Everything from empty pizza boxes and eggshells to broken dishes, appliances, old tires, and the kitchen sink. Worldwide, that's almost a billion tons of stinking trash every year. And somehow, all of it needs to be either recycled or otherwise disposed of. So, how do they do it? It's 6 a.m. in the San Francisco Bay Area, and Micah Bate and his refuse-wrangling colleague, John Fuston, are starting their weekly garbage collection round. For most of us, remembering to put out our trash bins is the end of the story. But in fact, it's just the beginning of an extraordinary, epic journey. A few years ago, strong men had to wrangle your garbage into the back of their truck. These days, a robot arm takes over that duty. One truck for recyclables, another for the truly trashy. Thanks to these robotic refuse collectors, Mike and John can empty 600 bins every trip. And once they're full of trash, the trucks head for a delightful spot known as the Davis Street Transfer Center. Trucks carrying waste for recycling deposit their load here. To you and me, it just looks like rubbish. But to the discerning eye, there's gold in them there hills. Each truckload is worth hundreds of dollars. But no one is going to pay for it in its present state. First, these vast mountains of trash need to be separated into the various components of paper, metals, plastics, and glass. Doing that by hand would require a small army. So it's a good thing they have George Atrestain and a friendly garbage monster known as the Single Stream Recycling Facility.
It's pretty incredible. It's noisy, it's dirty, it's very unglamorous, but it's a fun place to be.
George's smelly monster is a state-of-the-art garbage sorting machine. Housed in a building that's barely 300 feet long, it contains almost a mile of conveyor belts. Constantly fed by loaders, it can sort over 300 tons of waste every day and relies on George to keep the wheels turning. First, high-power fans blast a jet of air through the trash, suspending lighter paper, metal, and plastic, leaving the heavier glass bottles to fall into a separate pile. Next, a steep conveyor bounces the garbage across a series of rubber wheels. This causes the light paper products to continue upwards, while heavier metals and plastics drop down onto yet another conveyor belt.
Tarea 3. Dispone de un minuto para leer los ejercicios correspondientes a esta tarea. A continuación de la lectura, escuchará dos veces el texto o los textos orales correspondientes a la tarea 3, con un intervalo de 20 segundos. Tarea 3. Primera audición.
Today we're going to talk about Ireland and England, predominantly England, not because Ireland isn't important, but because we know less about Ireland. The reason we know relatively more about England in its post-Roman period, that is to say after 420, is because of the historian Bede writing in the early 8th century. A monk at Jarrow, which was a part of a twin monastery in North Umbria, which you see on your map, the northeastern part of England before you get to what's now Scotland. Bede wrote, among other things, a history of the English church and people, which is full of miracles and very, very, pro-Christian, as much as Gregory of Tours, but is a much more easy-to-follow narrative and a narrative with a certain kind of point. It's about the conversion of England and the establishment of the church. The other advantage for England over Ireland in terms of evidence is archaeology. A lot more has been done with excavating sites in England. Now, by England, we mean literally England, the part that is not Wales, not Scotland, not Ireland, the part of the British Isles. The ensemble, essentially the two islands, are referred to as the British Isles. Britain is England, Scotland, and Wales. Ireland is Ireland. The Britons, however, B-R-I-T-O-N-S, are the collective term for the Celtic population. Celtic is both a linguistic group and a somewhat vague ethnic term. It means the people who were there in the British Isles before the Romans came and who were there afterwards fighting invaders from Europe. These invaders, who come in the 440s, known as the Anglo-Saxons. Bede tells us it's the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes. The Angles give their name to England, Angoland. The Jutes we know nothing about. The Saxons come from, there is still a very large part of Germany called Saxony. What the nature of these peoples are, how they were differentiated among themselves, is a source of a lot of real, or at least looks real, scholarship as opposed to studying the Jutes.
Tarea 3. Segunda audición.
Today we're going to talk about Ireland and England, predominantly England, not because Ireland isn't important, but because we know less about Ireland. The reason we know relatively more about England in its post-Roman period, that is to say after 420, is because of the historian Bede writing in the early 8th century. A monk at Jarrow, which was a part of a twin monastery in North Umbria, which you see on your map, the northeastern part of England before you get to what's now Scotland. Bede wrote, among other things, a history of the English church and people, which is full of miracles and very, very, pro-Christian, as much as Gregory of Tours, but is a much more easy-to-follow narrative and a narrative with a certain kind of point. It's about the conversion of England and the establishment of the church. The other advantage for England over Ireland in terms of evidence is archaeology. A lot more has been done with excavating sites in England. Now, by England, we mean literally England, the part that is not Wales, not Scotland, not Ireland, the part of the British Isles. The ensemble, essentially the two islands, are referred to as the British Isles. Britain is England, Scotland, and Wales. Ireland is Ireland. The Britons, however, B-R-I-T-O-N-S, are the collective term for the Celtic population. Celtic is both a linguistic group and a somewhat vague ethnic term. It means the people who were there in the British Isles before the Romans came, and who were there afterwards fighting invaders from Europe. These invaders, who come in the 440s, known as the Anglo-Saxons. Bede tells us it's the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes. The Angles give their name to England, Angoland. The Jutes we know nothing about. The Saxons come from, there is still a very large part of Germany called Saxony. What the nature of these peoples are, how they were differentiated among themselves, is a source of a lot of real, or at least looks real, scholarship as opposed to studying the Jutes.
La prueba de comprensión oral ha finalizado. Deje su cuadernillo de examen cerrado sobre la mesa, compruebe que ha consignado en su portada los datos requeridos y siga las instrucciones del examinador.